Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Women in Horror Month podcast for April. My name is Ashley, and I'm your horror academic nerd. And with me is Hannah.
Hello, everybody. It's Hannah Neurotica here. Ashley and I have been spending the last few days reading Carol Clover's Men, Women, and Chainsaws, and we're really excited to talk about it tonight.
And amongst other various horror books and horror things that are written on paper. And I want to apologize right now and say, hey, it's late for both of us. We both unfortunately have day jobs, and we're both tired, and we're operating on coffee, on caffeine, and lots of it.
Yeah, I think that I'm pretty hopped up on coffee still.
But that being said, I think we did a fairly decent job. Hopefully, you have to tell us, because you guys are the listeners, and we just believe our own hype sometimes.
Be kind to us, please. So Ashley and I are going to be talking about Men, Women, and Chainsaws, Gender in the Modern Horror Film, which is by Carol J. Clover. Ashley, when I was reading this book today, I was thinking about not just, obviously, the ridiculous amount of fascinating subject matter to discuss, but also just the way that the book was discovered by you and sort of how it came into your life. And I don't know if you want to go first and then I can talk about my experience.
Well, basically, I remember it was my film class. I was an undergrad. It was probably I was a transfer student to the school that I eventually graduated from, so it was probably like my second year there, maybe. I was on the film school track, but that did not pan out because I'm not a filmmaker. I just like write. I learned to have a love for writing about films and not making them. That's just not my lane, basically. And so I took a film analysis class, which is where I found my love for writing about films, and I think I've mentioned this before, to Hannah personally, but it was really cool for the first time being in a class where we kind of had to work in groups on this like big paper project, but at the same time our papers were individual, so, you know, and there was like topics on the board that everyone was putting out there, because it was kind of like my instructor was like, you know, just kind of just go for it and, you know, see where the chips may fall and kind of, you know, it was more democratic. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this one guy wrote horror films and something, and it just, because I had no idea what I wanted to do, but I saw the word horror on the board, and I was like, that's what I want to do. That's what I'm writing a paper on for the very first time in my life. And so I just got up out of my seat, and I just went down there, and I wrote my name next to it, and I heard like a bunch of guys behind me go, yes! And I was like, really? I'm welcomed? This is nice. And so, you know, it was me and like three guys, and went up to them and they're like, hey, how's it going? And we just started talking about all these movies. And I was the one, I was saying, have you seen this? Have you seen that? And they're like, no, I just saw the first one. So I was like the one who's like seen like all the ridiculous sequels of, you know, X movie that has a franchise, X horror movie that has a franchise. Anyway, and so long story short, I think I wanted to focus on what I had been thinking about since I was a very, very young kid, about the fact that like there's all these like cool, powerful women at the end of the horror movies that I was able to be exposed to at the time, and that was the trend that I was seeing, that I was seeing women in film in a different light, unlike any other genre. Mm. And that's why that's one of the reasons horror really appealed to me, that whole final girl aspect. And I didn't really know I didn't know the term final girl until I picked up Clover's book. And so I knew I wanted to do something towards gender and horror, specifically with women in horror films. And, you know, doing, you know, how it's just basically what you do in college. It's about discovery. It's about, you know, kind of finding, kind of molding your identity in a sense. So that's how I found Carol Clover's book, just by doing research, because this is the paper I wanted to write about. I wanted to write about women in horror. I didn't know in what context, though. So I picked up the book and I couldn't put it down, basically. And yeah.
This book basically changed everything for me, because prior to it, I loved horror films so much. But when I started taking, which I've talked to you about as well, women's studies courses in college, for the first time, I started feeling guilty for liking slasher films, and I didn't have any people to really talk to about this. So I kind of suppressed my enjoyment for a while. And then when I moved out to Olympia, Washington, I went to Evergreen. I remember doing an internship at the Women's resource center on campus. And one day I walked in and there was this guy sitting there and he was reading Men, Women, and Chainsaws by Carol Clover. And I sat right down and was like, excuse me, what the fuck are you reading? And he showed it to me and I seriously could not believe that that fucking book existed. Like, it was like I had been trying to suppress my love of the genre because of this guilt. And then as soon as I discovered that not only the fact that the book existed, that there was a serious study of gender and horror, was just, it just exploded. It was like explosive to me that I could finally, you know, explore it in a more academic and sense. And then that lowered my feelings of guilt to actually see that I'm not a weird, horrible person because I like slasher films.
My aunt just asked me on last Saturday, she was like, what was your master's thesis on again? And I was like, women filmmakers. Like, I couldn't, like a part of me didn't want to say horror, like, because it was so, it's just, there's still this, like, I don't know if it ever goes away for some people, you know, who write about this stuff and like it so much. Because when you're in certain spaces that kind of frown upon it, it's...
It does feel weird when somebody who is completely not interested in this stuff and has their own idea of what it is and sort of still classifies it as almost pornography, to then say that you like it in a really serious way, it kind of... still, at least I do, have this judge, there's a feeling of judgment, like, that is hard to let go of, and it's hard to explain.
Because you're always thinking about, I think even from, that even that one time that you have such a negative response from someone when you tell them that you are into horror films, whether you're male or female, for me, I kind of expect that on some level, some sort of negative reaction or some sort of
eye-roll.
Yeah, and you shouldn't, I'm sorry, I'm not saying that right. You shouldn't expect that, but at the same time, it's kind of hard not to. Because it's still something that people don't fully understand in a way that there's a balance. You know, not everyone has to like or love horror films, but I think there's a lack of respect for its merit and a lack of insight on how it really impacts us, you know, widespread.
When Ashley and I decided to look at this book, we said we were going to basically read over it because we had read it a million times before. But it had been a few years since, I'm guessing, we both looked at it. Mm-hmm. Both are drawn to different parts of this book. And I'd love if you talked about the opening up chapter and what it is that you love about that chapter more than the others.
I think what I liked most about the opening up chapter was the fact that she kind of shifts her focus from... females to males, it has a delicate balance. She has a section that specifically speaks to the female story as well as the male story. But the good thing about this, about the opening up chapter, she focuses on the occult horror and specifically the subgenre of occult, which is possession. And she describes how it's the male story because of the male and these films have the arc. It's the woman in crisis, but at the same time, it's the male that kind of comes to terms with, you know, what's going on around him. And what specifically speaks to that is the whole idea of white science and black magic, which is kind of the first time I ever thought about those things. Now, when Carol Clover describes white science and black magic, this is page 66, she uses the terminology of the film The Serpent and the Rainbow, which was directed by Wes Craven. It was a movie that came out in the late 80s. And she describes white science as it refers to Western rational tradition. Its representatives are nearly always white males, typically doctors, and its tools are surgery, drugs, psychotherapy, and other forms of hegemonic science. Black magic, on the other hand, refers to Satanism, voodoo, spiritualism, and folk variants from Roman Catholicism, a world of crosses, holy water, seances, candles, prayer, exorcism, strings of garlic, beheaded chickens, and the like. Its inhabitants are blacks, Native Americans, mixed-race peoples, especially Cajun and Creole, and third world peoples in general. Children, old people, priests, Transylvanians, but first and foremost, women. And so I thought that was interesting because, you know, especially The Serpent and the Rainbow, which is one of my favorite movies, because I'm a Wes Craven fan. I followed his films, you know, throughout the times. And I like that because she makes very, you know, what I feel are obvious themes running through occult and possession films, very, very clear that, you know, white science is, you know, a world of white males, and it's a world of, you know, rationalism. But when you have these supernatural occurrences going on, and it's usually through the crisis of the woman's body and the woman's body being attacked, I think opening up speaks as much to a woman being open via our vaginas and just having that something that constantly makes us open and that constant. And again, that's symbolism to me too, the whole idea of opening up. We're already open, and that makes, and that's kind of a fear and a horror within itself, because our bodies are always under this, you know, there's always this undercurrent of tension that we could be attacked at any time. And that's that to me is extremely terrifying. But also, it's opening up for a man, and in the sense that, you know, for them it's terrifying to be open to something that is beyond their understanding. And that's kind of where white science comes in, and that's that, because that's their foundation. And then black magic comes in to kind of, you know, wreck that foundation. And they have to come to terms with that in order for the story to kind of move. And that's how I kind of understood this chapter.
Chapter that, I mean, I love all of the book, but the chapter that I think is my favorite is Getting Even, and it, specifically the part about Urbanoia.
Yeah.
That has always been my favorite part of this book, and I don't know if it's because I've gone, you know, growing up in New York City and then moving to New England, and just that way seeing the differences in how people view each other. But one of the things I was thinking when I was rereading this was how we've gone from back in the 80s, where you had, you know, people from the city going to the country, to more of national versus international, with films like Hostel. I think that became kind of a bigger theme later on. In the chapter Getting Even, she basically begins by talking about I Spit on Your Grave, which, if you're listening and have read it, you're very familiar with. But basically, the fact that she's this perceived rich woman, and they're perceived to be poor, and that's always the dichotomy. And I love, there's some sentence in here I'll have to find where she says that people's dental health, basically in a film, will tell you what's the word I want to use? God damn it.
Their class, their social status.
And if you're missing a tooth or you have bad teeth, you must be a pedophile, basically. and I think that that hasn't really changed at all, but it's definitely become more like American versus non-American. I don't know if you see that too, but that's the first thing I thought of when I reread it.
It is, I think, more so. I mean, yeah, I mean, you can. I almost wanted to stop you there, because, like, in the 80s, it was the whole Red Scare, because it was the Russians versus the U.S., and that was its own sort of xenophobia. But I think now, because, you know, the 80s were about, you know, 80s were just as much about, you know, the Red Scare, in a sense, as it was about, because the Cold War ended, you know, that was kind of like we were pushing towards the end. But, you know, but in the 80s, it was glitz and glamour, and it was technology and booms and everything. And there's a technological boom and all that great stuff. But I think now, because, you know, post 9/11, we were attacked here, we're getting bombed here. I think xenophobia has just kind of gone to a whole other level for Americans, and that's why I think movies like Hostel that kind of work, in a sense, you know, whether you like it or hate it, it does kind of, you know, it, like what you said, it talks about really exacerbating the idea of, you know, different countries and people from those different countries as an extreme other. So we reached out to some people on Twitter and Facebook. We asked the fans of Women in Horror Month on Facebook and on Twitter, what are some of your favorite nonfiction books on horror by women or about women or about gender in general. And we have quite a few responses. Some of them from Facebook. Chelsea Burden on Facebook. Thank you, Chelsea. She suggested the book. Let's see, find it here. It's called It Lives Again, Horror Movies in the New Millennium by XL Carolyn. The summary is basically a comprehensive analysis and overview of the state of horror cinema at the start of the 21st century. XL Carolyn discusses and dissects films from the Asian remake trends of The Ring and The Grudge to the so-called torture porn of the Saw and Hostel series, taking in independence and foreign productions as well as blockbusters. And Alexandra West, who is, I believe she's a horror academic herself out of Toronto and a former marketing assistant for the Visceral organization. Hello, Alexandra. Thank you for recommending The Dread of Difference, Gender, and the Horror Film. I had this book myself. It's just a book of essays, another book of essays again. It's some really great essays. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's great. So, also Andrew Scherer recommended Bev Zalcock's Renegade Sisters. Renegade Sisters is the title. The subtitle is Girl Gangs on Film. And this is, it's a cultural writing book. It says, from boarding school to women's prison, biker packs to urban vigilantes, witches coven to sex-crazed nuns, rampaging girl gangs have long been a staple feature of exploitation in underground cinema. Renegade Sisters examines the whole history of girl gangs on film, featuring many deviant displays of girl power from various genres and illustrated by dozens of stimulating photographs. Renegade Sisters is the ultimate guide to untamed celluloid. Sorry. It's late. Celluloid She-Devils, new, updated, and expanded edition, features additional chapters on delinquent nurses and fang gangs, vampire vixens.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
I would love to read something about girl gangs, actually. I'll have to check that out. Yeah.
I feel like I've read something similar to that. There are definitely essays about girl gangs. I have an anthology called The Subcultures Reader, and it basically goes through. There are sections or in like essays about girls and subcultures and about biker girls. But the one about biker girls is mostly kind of akin to their relationships to men and not necessarily their culture. But I think. I want to say when I was taking my American Studies classes, there was one essay I did read about kind of the girl gang culture. I think to the actress Mae West's relationship to girl gangs, because I think she was in one when she was a child, when she was a teenager. Oh. So we kind of talked about that. I think it was Mae West. So I could be mixing up my classic actress gems, but basically, yeah, but you get the idea. There are definitely essays on girl gangs.
Yeah, I'll have to check it out. So what other books did people recommend?
Eileen Winslow, from Facebook, she recommended Mary Roach's Stiff,
The Cure. Oh, that's such a good book.
Human Cadavers, yes. And it reminded me of the film that's yet to come out by Laurie Bowen and Shannon Lark called I Am Monster. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
That was a great book.
Yeah, Hannah, you talk about that book a little bit. Tell us.
So, first of all, Mary Roach is, if you're not familiar with her books, she just is such an engaging writer because she writes about these fascinating subjects in a way that it's not academic-y. It's like, it's just like you're having a conversation and it's really light while being heavy, kind of. So, you know, she talks about going to the body farm, which is like the most fascinating subject to me. It's basically a forensic, it's on campus. I can't remember the name of the university. On a campus at a university, and they basically study dead bodies in various situations just to document how they decompose to help solve murders. So they'll like put a body in a car and just like see what happens to it, or leave it out in you know, mud to see how bodies decay in mud. So it's so fascinating. So she was one of the few people that got to go there and writes about it. And she just really looks at sort of what the body does as it dies and decays. And it's just so fascinating. And she actually has another book that does the same thing, but it's about sex. And I highly recommend any of her books, but Stiff is really great.
Very nice. Yeah. Very nice.
But yes. Yes. But so what else do people recommend, Ashley?
Rachel Hoover from Facebook again. She recommended Chicago Haunts, Ghostly Lore of the Windy City by Ursula Bielski. And it's basically, the synopsis is, with the first edition of Chicago Haunts, author Ursula Bielski captured 160 years of Chicago's haunted history in the first volume ever devoted to this intriguing subject. Combining lively storytelling with in-depth historical research, exclusive interviews, and insights from parapsychology, Bielski penned a unique and fascinating exploration of the region's supernatural folklore. So, you know, basically kind of like a historical approach to hauntings and accounts of that in Chicago, which I think for, yeah, I would be interested to check out this book to see how it's different from any other city.
Yeah, I definitely like the, so far, people have a good mix of the kind of books they're recommending.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Lots of different angles on horror.
One we got from Twitter from her name is Melanie Light, and she's a filmmaker.
She is awesome.
Yes, and she recommended Sandra Lee's Kathy the Cannibal. And Kathy the Cannibal is the shocking true story of Catherine Knight and her heinous crimes, the ritual slaying for her part. Of her partner for a cannibal feast. Knight was a 44-year-old slaughterhouse worker who stabbed father of three, John Price, 37 times, skinned his body, cooked his head, and served him up for his children in an atrocious act that rocked her town and chilled the world to the bone.
Wow.
Wow.
That sounds like something I gotta check out.
Melanie's suggestions were heavy.
I don't know, there's so many books to check out. I want to check them all out.
there is so many books, and we forgot one of the other bigger ones, Recreational Terror.
I was going to mention that. Yes, that is such a great book, Recreational Terror. What's the subtitle?
Women and the Pleasures of Horror Film Viewing.
Yes, Isabel Pinedo. She's excellent.
Can you tell us how her classes are like, and tell her where she teaches?
So I love that book, and I contacted Isabel and told her how much I loved her book. And then years later, she was teaching a course at Hunter College in New York City, media, film and media post 9/11. And so she invited me to the class, which was incredible. And she's so brilliant. And to have had the honor to sit in a classroom with her and go have, like, I remember one day I was working on a paper I wanted to write. And I mean, she sat with me and we talked about the ideas, and to be able to talk to someone who had such a brilliant view on the genre as a woman was such a gift from the world. And her book is seriously, I know Ashley's read it too. And if you can get your hands on it, it's excellent.
Yeah, I have to stop saying if, because this is too ingrained in my DNA not to do it. When I finally get the opportunity to teach or lecture a class about horror films, this is definitely the book I'm going to be using with my students. So future students, be prepared.
Get the book now. So she's if you have the opportunity to take a class with her, you won't regret it. It's a great, great, great experience.
And that's great to hear.
Yeah. Recommend two, The Monstrous Feminine Film Feminism Psychoanalysis by Barbara Creed. And also a lesser known book, I think, that came out by Alexandra Heller Nicholas. And it's called A Critical Study, Rape Revenge Films. And it came out on McFarlane Press out of the University of Melbourne in Australia. And Alexandra contacted me years and years and years ago because she was interested in my rape revenge issue of my zine. And she said she was working on a book about rape revenge. And so, you know, we talked through email. And then years later, I got her book in the mail. And it is a book that more people should definitely check out. It really delves into, whereas Carol Clover's book has the chapter on rape revenge, her whole book deals with it through film, but also just very in-depth throughout all different kinds of films, whether it's Deliverance or Death Proof by Quentin Tarantino. So I just wanted to recommend that.
Great. I want to make one more recommendation, and this is not because I am in this issue. It is not.
It is totally not.
Deeply appreciate this magazine for everything that it is. Paris Cinema Magazine, and hopefully we'll get the editor on the show one day soon. This was a couple of years ago, so this was back in February 2011, which I thought was very fitting for Women in Horror Month. They premiered their women's issue, which I was able to write an article for. And, you know, this issue was packed with so many wonderful articles. There was an article on Frankenhooker by Lisa Cunningham. There was one actually on rape revenge films by the author is Chelsea Suarez. There was an article on Twin Peaks, on mental illness, and Let's Scare Jessica to Death. So there were so many great articles in that issue, and it was written, they're all written by women, and I thought that was really great. And so if you could check out paracinema.net, you could order that issue there. It may be sold out, so, and this is a print magazine, it's not digital. I mean, it's something that you could, you know, hold and hug and, you know, smell. And she, you know, Christine is a real proponent for, you know, physical media still, you know, even though it's a dying medium, but it's still here with us. So if you want to check out Paris Cinema and check out these issues, and, you know, I may have the cover. I'm just saying, you know. You know, I did my best with the article I wrote, so, and I'm proud of it. It's one of my first big accomplishments. My article was about The Exorcist, so it was called the title of my article was Demystifying Superwoman, Shifty Gender Roles, Hysterical Moms, and Pissed Off Daughters in The Exorcist. Nice. So that was my article.
So Ashley and I were really excited to talk to Leanne Spiderbaby because she has a book coming out called Grindhouse Girls, Cinema's Hardest Working Women. And she actually read from the introduction and talked to us a lot about the term grindhouse and sort of what it's come to mean now versus the grindhouse days. So, you know, let's stay tuned and listen to her reading from the book and discussing all of these wonderful, exciting, awesome, horrific things with us.
Grindhouse exhibition allowed spectators to undergo in the theater what they were subjected to on screen, creating an entirely different experience from that at a major theater and multiplexes today. Located within the esteemed Broadway theater area in Times Square was America's most notorious red light district. Its main section was known as the Deuce, a tiny strip of grimy lights and theaters that spanned 42nd Street during exploitation's golden age. The Deuce had wall-to-wall grindhouses with large auditoriums, balconies, big screens, velvet curtains, and opera-style seating. The Deuce grindhouses were showcases for the wildest and most extreme films in cinematic history, many of which will be further discussed in this book. There were several reasons to venture out to the grindhouses: to score drugs, engage in foolish one-night sexual behavior, to be part of a diverse crowd, or to view a double bill of the wildest film imaginable. However, the grindhouses have an attraction even more powerful and mesmerizing that could not be seen anywhere else. On-screen actresses who kicked ass, stripped naked, were often covered in stage blood, and weren't afraid to get down and dirty for the sake of their acting career. Without these ladies, the film would not exist. But what is it that makes these exploitation films so appealing to modern audiences? And what is it about exploitation films that are extraordinarily appealing to females? In the 1970s, both men and women were lined up around the block in New York City on 42nd Street, vying to get into the premiere of Ginger, directed by Don Chayne in 1971, and even more exploitive and pornographic, Damiano's Deep Throat in 1972. The theme that will run through Grindhouse Girls has to do with whose fantasy is satisfied by the gender trouble of exploitation films, and more specifically, the prominent actresses that starred in them. There's something about these strong and beautiful women in exploitation films that is very appealing to women. It is easily understood why beautiful, occasionally naked and sexual women are alluring to men, but what is it exactly about these exploitation actresses that women find so attractive? The chapters of this book will discuss, profile, and celebrate exploitation actresses that were working and starring in films during exploitation's golden age. Each chapter is dedicated to an actress, and many include interviews and quotes that I conducted myself between 2010 and 2011. These actresses are artists and in many ways should be respected for going against the grain in their careers and for making it against all odds. Many of these women are still enjoying acting careers, while others have chosen different career paths, but are quite proud of the work they did in exploitation filmmaking. Grindhouse Girls gives these actresses and their work extra meaning and love, since they were able to get past the low budget and lurid subject matter in order to create films that are truly extraordinary. This is what makes them cinema's hardest working women. For the love of acting and film, they were willing to do whatever it took, and whatever it took, they often did.
Thank you so much. I am so excited for your book, Leanne.
I'm excited for it too. It's finally getting off the ground, and I finally have a publisher, and I don't have to get rejected anymore.
Is this a book that you've been trying to get out there for a long time? So, because that was one of my questions, if this was sort of a newer idea or something you've wanted to do for a long time.
Yeah, well, it's funny because when I talk to people about it, you know, they all sort of are like, oh, how's the book coming? And I was like, well, it actually came about a year and a half ago. It was finished. And then, of course, I've done rewrites on it. So in September, just this past year, in 2012, I really went back into the book and really fixed it up and made it into something much bigger and what I think is much better. And now I'm in the editing stages with the editor, but it has been done for a while. So I think I started it in 2010. So I guess it'll be 3 years altogether.
I was curious, you know, that you, when you were reading, you said how, I think you said each chapter is going to be focused on a different woman. Can you talk about some of the women that are represented in the book?
Yeah, for sure. I had to narrow it down to seven. So there's 17 actresses featured. So Tora Sutana is in there, and Diane Thorne, Christina Lindbergh, Laura Gemser, Camille Keaton, Edwige Finney, Pam Grier, Lynn Lowry, Tiffany Bowling, and Sybil Danning. So I tried to, I was really conscious of including women of different race and different countries as well. So there are two women from Japan, two women from Italy as well. So just because I think exploitation cinema definitely wasn't just an American phenomenon. It was a conscious decision also to stay away from, there's been a couple names that have popped up and people have asked me if I'm featuring women like Rainbow Smith or Lena Romay, and I wasn't really interested in women's stories if they became really involved with drugs. So in the case of Rainbow, like, she died of an overdose. So that just kind of doesn't really fit the particular thesis of my book. These women were working in the 1970s. So, I mean, drug use is, you know, it's there. But I'm talking like heroin, that kind of heavy drug use that eventually ruined their careers, and in some cases were their demise of their lives. I left those actresses out because basically my book essentially celebrates women that were working extremely hard on these really low budget movies. And I think that so many years after the fact, spectators, especially female spectators, we can look at these movies, and I think that the films have feminist aspects because of the work of these actresses. So, a really good example that I use in my book, sort of a counterpoint, is there's been this whole resurgence of people who are really into femme fatales from film noir. Mm-hmm. And these femme fatales have kind of become feminist icons. And I think that we can look at exploitation filmmaking today and in some of the films that I talk about in my book, and, you know, especially the films that these actresses were in, I think that we can look at their characters in these movies as feminist the same way that we look at femme fatales and film noirs as feminist. But what's really interesting to me in the exploitation films is often these women aren't punished for their independence. They're not punished for murdering people in the same way that a femme fatale is. So the example that I really like to use is in I Spit on Your Grave, with starring Camille Keaton. She is brutally raped, and it's an awful and horrifying scene. But after her rape, it remains her story, and she goes out and she brutally murders all of the people that raped her, the men that raped her. And after she kills all of them, she's not punished for that. Like, she's not thrown in jail. She doesn't die. There's no punishment there's no consequences for her actions, because the rape has justified her murders. Like, it's all good in that movie. Whereas a film like Double Indemnity, which is a film noir, Barbara Stanwyck's character, she is independent. She's out for herself and into money, and she does swindle this whole little deal. But then at the end of the film, she's ultimately punished for her independent woman actions. So I think while I relate exploitation to film noir, I think that exploitation goes a step further, which makes sense because the films were made how many years after the fact. And I think now that enough time has gone by, we can now, as spectators like you and I, we can watch these exploitation films. And I think that they do have feminist aspects. By no means am I arguing that the films aren't exploitive. They definitely are. And I wouldn't champion I Spit on Your Grave as a feminist film at all. But I do think that there are elements of feminism that should be celebrated, certainly in respect to the women that play these characters.
Yeah, and I mean, the ending of I Spit on Your Grave is like one of my most favorite cinematic moments. But Ashley, I heard you about to say something.
No, I was glad. I was going to say, Leanne, that I'm really glad that you made that distinction between the characters and the trajectory of those characters versus the film itself, and seeing the film as a whole as feminist versus, you know, what these women did behind the camera as well as in front of the camera. I think that's really important to bring to a discussion, because I think sometimes that gets lost in the translation when you're discussing feminist film theory or just feminism in film in general, because there's never a clear distinction of the discussion of, you know, the characters and the women versus the film itself. So that's why I just wanted to bring that into the fold.
Absolutely.
That's it. You know, I was thinking, I think Ashley and I had been talking about this, you know, people ask me in interviews, like, what is a feminist horror film? And I just feel like that is, like, you know, when you're looking at films from so many different angles, whether you're looking at the film as a whole or if you're looking at characters, and the way that feminism is defined so differently, it's such a hard thing to define. So I'm just wondering if, you know, if this is a question you've been asked, and if, you know, if you have, how have you answered, or how would you answer if someone asked you about the existence of a feminist horror film?
Yeah, I mean, it's more a conversation I've had with other women that love the genre. It's never, it's a really interesting thing, and I'm not even really sure how to answer it, because I'm not sure that there has been a horror film that I would say is feminist. Like, there's usually something that happens, just because of society that we live in, that could qualify a film as not feminist. And I'm really, more than anything else when it comes to film and film theory, I'm really interested in spectatorship practices, how we as individuals watch movies based on our gender or based on culture or background, experience, race, everything else. Like, we all come into the theater and watch a movie, and no two women are going to have the same experience and the same, they may share the same opinions about a certain film, but their experience is different naturally because they're different people. So, I mean, I'm really careful not to, if one woman finds a movie to be feminist and I disagree, I'm really careful to not put labels on things, like, oh, well, I disagree with you, it's not feminist, so there. Because I do think for everyone that viewing experience is so different, that it's one person's, you know, it's
subjective.
What one person thinks is feminist, exactly, and what one person finds empowering or feminist may be different than what I find to be the same thing. So
absolutely, it's all about what brings you as an individual a sense of empowerment. Because we're all coming from such a different place, it's not always going to be the same thing. Do you have any plans to explore that further now that you're done, almost done with this?
I mean, it's definitely something that I explore with articles that I write. And especially if I write something for Video Watchdog, it's almost always looking at the social consciousness of particular films or something like that. But as far as books go, I'm not sure. I mean, I think that the next book that I'm going to start working on will have a historical context and a bit of a social, you know, it's going to look at the films as social subjects within history, but I sort of want to do something really different, mm-hmm. and something very different from Grindhouse Girls. So I think just looking at social subjects in movies, probably more of an article thing.
So that leads me into asking you about, you know, where I know the answer to this, but where can people read your work? I know Fangoria. I mean, you pretty much write for all the big ones.
Yeah. So Video Watchdog for sure. I have an article coming up in, there's an issue that's going to be shipped out this month. So it's going to be the following issue after that. I have an article that compares, the French Emmanuel series with Sylvia Kristel to the Italian Emmanuel series with Laura Bemser. And of course, because Sylvia Kristel just passed away. So I look at those, the films of both actresses, and that has a feminist spin on it as well. So that article comes out in Video Watchdog, okay. Upcoming. Famous Monsters I write for a lot, and that's more classic horror pieces. And I have an article in the current issue, and in the next issue coming out, I think it's dedicated to the work of Peter Cushing, so I have an article in that as well. And yeah, Fangoria I write for on a regular basis, and now I'm also writing for FearNet as well. So, and my website always has stuff. But
oh, and that's LeanneSpiderBaby.com, correct?
Yes.
So I want to ask you a question that I think a lot of people want to know the answer to, Leanne. When is Fright Bites coming out?
Oh my gosh. So actually, as we're speaking right now, I'm uploading an episode.
Awesome. So can you tell us about it?
Not finished. Well, it's a review of Evil Dead, nice. The new Evil Dead. Yeah, which I saw on Friday, and it's spoiler free. So it's going to be up online in 5 minutes.
I want to see it so bad.
Yeah, me too.
Looking forward to it.
Sorry. I'm just so excited to talk to you about it. Go ahead. Keep talking.
Yeah. I've shot a couple of other things for other upcoming episodes. And I'm going to a convention in April back home in Toronto. Well, it's actually in London, Ontario. It's called Shockstock. It's a great convention. I go to it every year, but they've got some really great guests this year, so I'm going to be shooting there with my brother again. So we're going to have regular episodes from now on. It was just kind of a tricky time. I think the last time I shot one was something embarrassing, like October or November. And then it just, in moving to Los Angeles, it just got really busy and really chaotic. And then I was dealing with that's when my book was going through the signing process.
Oh, wow.
Where I was working with the publisher and my agent to get it signed. So it just got a little bit too nuts, and we just weren't shooting any episodes.
So I guess I didn't realize that you worked with your brother.
Yeah, and on Fright Bites, it's my younger brother.
That's so funny, because on this episode that we're doing, Ashley and I were talking to Barbara Muschietti, and she talks a lot about living with her brother while they were writing Mama. So it's interesting, the theme that I didn't realize was there about brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're best friends, and it would be really easy to shoot Fright Bites because we would just literally go into our basement, and that's where we had the set. So,
oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, and he loves horror movies, so we do everything together, and I think his insights are so good. Like, my brother is so much smarter and cooler than I am. So I often just, you know, I make him tag along to places, or I had him come on the show just because it just makes everything that I do seem that much better.
That's so funny. So you guys clearly get along. Have you always been creative together? Is it like a new thing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, even as kids, we would set up little recitals and, you know, show off our talents to our parents. Like, we've always been really, really good friends. And the Fright Bites thing was just something that happened really naturally. And it was really convenient. He's also, he writes music. He wrote the score for a film called In the House of Flies, which is a Canadian independent horror film directed by Gabriel Carrère, and it's really excellent. Yeah, so he did the score for that, and, you know, would have me listen to it and see what I thought. And so, yeah, I mean, I think we work together a lot more now, but it's been really great.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So how, can we ask you one or two more questions? Are you?
Oh my God. Yeah. I have like, so good.
How is it, living out in LA compared to where you were before?
It's good. I mean, it definitely like anywhere else, it takes some adjusting, it takes some time getting used to it, but, you know, it's really great. I've got a solid group of friends here that I spend time with, and it's been cool. I've been able to go to a lot of events and see things and meet new people, and even just seeing Evil Dead early. I mean, Toronto screenings for that too, but it is a really cool thing. I'm really enjoying being out here.
I'm just curious, how was, I don't know if you can say how the remake was, but was it good?
Oh gosh. I want to know so bad. It's so good. Yeah.
Is it really?
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's amazing. The Fright Bites episode, literally it's done. It's processing right now.
Oh, so awesome.
But yeah, it's so impressive. It's so bloody. It's so much fun. It's definitely the kind of movie you'll need to see in theaters for sure.
Oh, I'm so glad, because the preview looked so good and I was like, oh, I hope this isn't going to get my hopes up. So that's really good to know.
Yeah, no, you're going to love it.
So, I just have to ask you, what did it feel like to go to the Oscars? You've been asked this question a bazillion times.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely, I mean, I think when I was 4 years old, or, you know, 4 or 5, like just so young, and I watched them on television with my family, I was like, I want to go there one day. That's all I want to do. And then somehow, and I never wanted to be an actress or anything like that. So I wasn't sure how that I was going to make that happen. and then my boyfriend was nominated for some stuff. So I got to go, and it was the most incredible experience. But it is kind of interesting because I got to go to the Golden Globes as well.
Yeah.
And the Oscars are not half as much fun as the Golden Globes. I wish they burst in order, because the Golden Globes are just so much fun. I mean, you sit at a table and everyone just has a really good time. So, yeah. But, I mean, it was incredible. It was amazing. And my dress, Mara Hoffman designed this really beautiful dress for me. And I just consider myself to be so lucky and fortunate. And it was really incredible.
Have you been getting any unwanted attention? Or, how's that working?
Yeah, I would say it's funny. I would say yes, of course. But at the same time, it hasn't been overly negative unwanted attention. So,
oh, good.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's brought a lot of traffic to the website. And I think that's a good thing in terms of, you know, how I write about horror movies. Like, I think it creates an awareness for the kinds of issues that we're all interested in. And, you know, I want the book to be a success, especially more so, less having to do with royalties, but that's also really cool if it sells a lot.
Yeah.
But, because I really do, I genuinely love every single woman featured in my book. And, a couple of them I've become really close to in particular. And I just love that there's going to be this place where you know, their name is in print again, and it's in such a positive and celebratory light. I just really love that idea. I love that I've been able to do this for them, and I'm really excited about it. So if people have found me because I appeared at the Oscars, then that's wonderful in that respect.
That's a great way to put it. I mean, we need more books like that, more positive representations of the women that have given themselves to this art form. And I just think it's great. I cannot wait to read it.
Thank you.
I have to say I'm embarrassed because I don't know if I asked you this question already.
Oh, that's okay.
If I did, just tell me. But in your research and your interviews, were you surprised by anything? Did you learn anything really, like something that you just had no clue about? Or anything that just kind of, you know, stuck out to you?
Yeah, I mean, nothing that really surprised me. I mean, I'm always surprised by what the women end up doing after the fact. One of the girls became a kindergarten teacher, which it's like, you know, that's kind of weird just because,
that's awesome.
It's amazing that she was able to get a job as a kindergarten teacher after.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. So there's that. And then, you know, one of them is now a beekeeper. She lives in the Hollywood Hills, and she does all this really amazing work for honeybees.
Wow.
Which is kind of crazy as well. Like, she went from bee movies to beekeeping. It's totally kind of really interesting, but bizarre at the same time. But I think during the book, I was supposed to interview an actress named Tally Cochran. And we kept having to reschedule our interviews because she wasn't doing well. She was she wasn't in great health, but she desperately wanted to talk to me because she hadn't done a whole lot of interviews. And Tally's really interesting because she was an agent to several pornographic actors in New York. Like, she was John Holmes's agent for a little while, which is awesome because, yeah. And I really was looking forward to her interview. And then I'll never forget the day where I was on Facebook, and I hadn't spoken to her in a little while. And then one person... a mutual friend of ours had posted that she had died.
Oh, wow.
And it just, I mean, she had told me that she had beat cancer. So, you know, I always thought she was in recovery, but that didn't happen. So it was really kind of devastating because I was left with these emails, these conversations that we'd had back and forth. And I never got a chance to talk to her, which was really sad. So what was, you know, good about the aftermath of all that, though, I mean, it was really upsetting, and I had a good cry about it because it just seemed so bizarre and strange and upsetting. But I was also really happy that at least she's going to be featured in the book. And the mutual friend of ours, Mark, he sent me an interview he did with her about 3 years ago. And it was a really, really long interview. And he was like, you know, I haven't used it for anything. So, you know, you can use it and write your chapter based on the information that's in here. So, yeah, which is really, really amazing.
That's great.
Yeah. So she's still featured in the book as well.
Oh, wow. That's really wonderful.
I was going to ask a couple of questions, but I guess the one at the forefront at the moment is, I know a lot of people get intimidated by the process of writing a book, especially, you know, contacting people who are relatively well known. You know, could you give any advice to people who are aspiring writers, who may be interested in writers, especially women writers who want to, you know, contact different people who seem larger than life, but, you know, may be intimidated by the process? Like, you know, how'd you go through it? And if you had any blunders or doubts yourself?
Well, I definitely think that I knew really early on when I started writing for Fangoria that to be really taken seriously in the world of journalism, you need to have that book. So really, I just chose something. I chose a topic that I'd always had interest in. I did some work on grindhouses and spectatorship in university. So I knew that that was something I loved and wanted to pursue. So I think that if you're, you know, thinking about writing a book, the best thing to do is choose something that you really love and then be very calculated about how you
go about pursuing it. Like, it's a good idea to start small and just let your book grow sort of on its own, and give yourself enough time. Like, don't put deadlines on yourself, because, you know, it's going to take you a long time to get a, to find the right publisher. So there's no need to really rush through anything, but just to really let it start small and then let it grow bigger, and write about something that you love, because you are going to come up against walls where you are denied interviews or where you're denied publishing. Like, this stuff is going to happen. And, you know, definitely for my book, I've ended up in the best case scenario, despite the fact that it was, my book was rejected 4 times. Like, it could not have worked out better than it has. And I think that extra time and not putting too much pressure on myself or the book really has helped me in the long run. And in terms of, I mean, most people that I've approached for interviews are extremely happy to speak with me. I was really lucky in the sense that a lot of the women that I wanted to interview have already been interviewed by a really, really good friend of mine who does a lot of the documentary extras, and he records the commentary for DVDs, a lot of these exploitation films. So, and he also directed American Grindhouse. So Elijah Drenner is the director of that movie. He's a really good friend of mine, and he's very connected in the exploitation grindhouse circles. So he was able to connect me with people that already had a working relationship with him. They liked the interviews that he did with them, so they were willing to speak with me because of that. And I found, too, a lot of the women were willing to speak to me because I was female as well. So it was interesting for them to have a female interview them, because it's something that doesn't happen very often for them. Mm-hmm. But it was a different kind of conversation in some cases, which they also really enjoyed. But, you know, like, I get turned down for interviews all the time, or you have to go through publicists or things like agents. I mean, it's going to happen. And, you know, mm-hmm. sometimes you get rejected in one route and then you just have to find another. Mm-hmm. And so you do it. But you've got to expect coming up against those walls, because it happens. Yeah. But if you're not putting too much pressure on yourself, then it's okay. You just get back up and dust yourself off and then find another route. So whoever you're trying to interview.
Yeah, basically it feels like, you know, you just have to have confidence in yourself that if someone isn't interested, that someone else will be. And like you said, I mean, you're publishing with St. Martin's, right?
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
I mean, that's a great yeah. publisher.
Yeah.
So it seems like, you know, it's great that, you know, the other ones maybe didn't work out, so you could be with this great publisher.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
I kind of want to go back to the term grindhouse itself, because I think it gets thrown around a lot, and
yeah.
people don't fully understand exactly what it means. And I'm kind of glad in your introduction that you kind of talk about, you know, you give a historical context for it. So if you could kind of talk about that a little bit more. And I think my question more so is, like, how do you feel like the term itself became a genre of film?
Yeah, right. Yeah. And I think that's pretty much what I was going to say, is I think that the grindhouses were a place. They were a place where you went and saw movies, and it was a certain kind of movie that would play there, because, you know, the A-list films weren't showing at these crappy theaters. Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, exactly what you just said. Nowadays, grindhouse has become less of a theater and an experience, but it's become a genre for mm-hmm. movies that, I don't know. I mean, I guess they're poorly made on purpose, but a lot of these exploitation films weren't poorly made on purpose. They just were lower budget.
Right.
So it's kind of an interesting, it's an interesting thing. And I guess it became popular in 2007 after Robert Rodriguez and Quinn released Grindhouse. And it got confused after that, because when I saw that in theaters, it was a double feature with some trailers in the middle. And that's very much how you would see a film at a grindhouse. It would be a double feature. There'd be some trailers in the middle. and the film subject matter, you know, they were exploitation films because those are the kinds of movies that people went to the grindhouse. That's what they wanted to see. They're lowbrow, low-budget films that exploit something to the fullest. Now it's like we'll call an independent, low-budget horror movie with, you know, shot on digital with a yellow haze over it, we'll call that a grindhouse movie. Or just if it's an exploitation film, now all of a sudden we're calling it a grindhouse film because, mm-hmm. yeah, it is a weird thing, though, totally. I don't really know. For me, grindhouse means it's a location.
Is there anything else that you'd like to promote or mention that we can share with listeners?
I don't think so. I mean, we talked magazines, we talked Fright Bites, and we talked book. I think that's
great.
That's about it.
Awesome. Well, go get that episode up so we can watch it.
Yeah, it's online right now.
Oh, see? I can't see it because I'm talking to you.
Yeah, we can hang up the conversation, and it'll be there. It's up. So I'm going to start promoting it and posting it everywhere.
Well, I will go do the same thing.
Oh, thank you. Absolutely. It has 3 views so far. 3. That's Woo. Great.
You'll have more shortly.
I hope so. Yay. Okay.
Take care, Leanne. I'll let you know as soon as this is up.
It was awesome talking to you both. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
It's an honor. Thank you. Have a great night.
You too. See ya.
Okay. So thank you for listening. You can find Hannah, where can they find you?
On the internet.
Everywhere on the internets. Just like everyone else, I am on Facebook, HannahNerotica.com, AxeWinZine.com, WomenInHorrorMonth.com, and at HannahNerotica on Twitter. And pretty much if you put my name into Google, you'll find me. I'm all over.
I am less easy to find because I usually just go by my first name. If I go by my first name, I'm Ashley, and my website is quirksandsplatters.com. You can find me on Twitter. My handle is MustLoveHorror. And I am also, I'm not on Facebook, but my event is on Facebook. If you just want to follow and like and support my event that I have every February for Women in Horror Month, it's facebook.com/PhillyLovesWomenInHorror.
And yes, Ashley did just say she is not on Facebook. She is the only person I know, and I respect that so greatly. So, yes, she really is not on Facebook.
I am a lady of obscurity. So
seriously, Ashley's like Madonna. It's like, Ashley. the mysteries of Ashley.
So we have some, goodness gracious, we have some wonderful more themed episodes coming up. We'll keep you posted on it all. We thank you for listening. We had a great time recording this, even though we were all over the place, because I feel that academic anything is it's so complicated, and it's based on discourse. So you're going to be all over the place when you're talking about certain topics, and it's a good thing because it opens yourself up to more ideas, and Absolutely. We like that, and we hope you like that too. And we really wanted to engage the audience more, which is why we put that question out there. And in the future, we're going to put more questions out there so we can get you guys involved in the discourse as well.
Absolutely. And if you're listening and if you've read, any of the books we've talked about, let us know what you think of them. Let us know your thoughts on Carol Clover's book. And if you've never read Carol Clover's book, we'd love to, if you are inspired to or interested to pick it up, let us know what you think about it. Because there's a lot in that book that we did not talk about. There's so much.
Yes. And we know, because I know it myself, because I would do it too, and we know some of you are screaming because we missed certain elements. So feel free to kind of come back and tell us what we missed and put your 2 cents in. 2 cents.
Absolutely, and only 2 cents. We don't have time for more.
Yes, unfortunately. Unfortunately.
But if honestly, I think that this is a subject that Ashley and I love, and I think it is a type of show that we are going to come back to. So there'll be more discussion on academic writings of horror in the future.
Yep.
Thank you so much for listening, everyone.
Bye, everybody.
See you next month.